This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at the Zen Center of New York City. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of Zen Mountain Monastery and ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
Good evening, everybody. It's nice to see you all. I can almost see you, blinded by the lights. So this is the second, I believe, in a series of, thank you, in a series of Mondo on the precepts, which is a wonderful series to do. And so what I wanted to do is just say a few things to get us started. A few things about the precepts themselves, and then this particular precept that we're working with tonight. And then to open it up for questions and explore this further with you. So, since the time of the Buddha, the teaching of morality as embodied or expressed in the precepts has been a central teaching, a teaching that can't be divided or separated out from the whole. So the Buddha said that the three essential aspects of what we call practice are morality, sometimes referred to as the discipline in the early literature, the calming of the mind, developing stability and tranquility in the mind, samadhi, concentration, and then to gain understanding, direct understanding, insight, realization. And that those three aspects work together and are interdependent, that they in a sense, feed one another, but also feed back into each other in a very important way. In the early teachings, the Buddha emphasized, when he talked about morality, that when we don't live in a... Well, first of all, in his realization, in his enlightenment, he basically saw that we are fundamentally moral beings, that is our basic nature. The reason for that being that we experience pain and pleasure. We tend to gravitate towards what is pleasurable, and here... Think of pleasure as not just superficial pleasures, but all that is life-affirming, and that we tend to move away from all that is painful, or think of it as life-denying. And so that within us, biologically, sort of structurally, if you will, we experience things in terms of whether they are creating or destroying life. We think of it in the largest sense. And that because we move towards pleasure and away from pain, or towards life and away from destruction of life, that we are fundamentally moral. And so that we live in a moral universe as human beings. And so he also realized that because of the nature of karma, that we create all that is good, as well as creating all that is not good, all that is affirming of life and all that is destructive of life. And so his teaching was a kind of radical interiorizing of human life, because all that moves outwards, all that is expressed outwards, originates within, in our intentions, which is the birth of karma, which results in our experience of the world, inner and outer, as either being heaven or hell. And so in that way, he said that when we live in a way that is in accord with this basic nature, our morality, compassion, that in one of your early teachings, he said that then we don't have regret. And when we don't live with remorse and regret, which is a very heavy thing to live with, then we are naturally more joyful. The body is more relaxed. Our concentration becomes deeper. a general sense of joy and lightness of being naturally comes forth. And that in that deeper state of concentration, which is now available to us because we're not agitated in remorse, that that, in a sense, opens the door to direct understanding or realization. And so again and again, he drew this very, very close interrelatedness between what we're doing with our thoughts, words, and actions as expressed in the precepts, and how that not only plays itself outwards on each other, but the emphasis in the early teachings and in much of his teachings, I mean, it was understood that that was going to create harm for others. But because the early emphasis in the teachings was on self-liberation, he brought it back again and again to one's own experience and how it plays into or works against our meditation, our zazen, the development of the calming of our mind, and the gaining of realization, the transformation of our way of seeing the world. And so in that way, what we think of as the precepts themselves, these teachings and practices, are intimately intertwined with the path. He also, because of the nature of karma, originating in intention, the Buddha said intention is karma, that when we have a desire and we bring forth an intention that then moves forth through our thoughts into words and actions, that creates karma. Those actions have consequence, which have a karmic weight, you might say, or karmic impact. And that impact can either be life-affirming or life-negating. And because of the nature of intention, and this was a sort of a radical, not radical in the sense that it was something that he created, but a radical discovery, we might say, of the Buddhas, that is the essence of that interiorizing of the human project. Because all of our actions issue forth from intention until we're perfectly enlightened. And in that way, all that we're creating in the world, which is coming forth and also feeding back onto ourselves, originates in intention, which means we have to study the mind. We have to understand very deeply and begin to transform a lot of these negative, sort of life-destroying or life-negating or just life-obstructing habit patterns of mind, of thought, of speech, of action that obstruct and obscure. And this is really important because it helps us to understand and appreciate the precepts as more than a set of rules. And this is something I emphasize a lot because I don't like rules that much. Funny how I found my way into this particular life. I don't like them when they're rules. And so in my early practice, when I encountered the precepts, I didn't want to just live by rules. I wanted to live by something that was alive, right? That was based in something that I trusted deeply. And it wasn't just, you know, what somebody else said or was an institutional thing or whatever. And, you know, part of that was just my stupidity and my arrogance, in no small part. But what it did was it helped me to work with these teachings and so much of what happens in training, in a way to bring them to life, because that's how I wanted to relate to the Dharma. That's how I wanted to live. So let me say, in terms of the precept we're going to study tonight, to be giving and not steal. Now, of course, this precept appears in almost every moral teaching in any religion or spiritual tradition. but I want to say a few words about how the different ways it's understood. So there are basic moral teachings that are common to all of Buddhism. So if you look at the first five precepts, those are common to all schools of Buddhism. There's a direct understanding. So to be giving, do not steal. And in the traditional expression of the precepts, oftentimes you'll just see the sort of the stopping action. Do not steal, do not take life. You know, do not cloud the mind and use intoxicants and so on. But implicit in that is the affirming side. So when we're not stealing, what are we doing? We're being giving. And that's really important. And it's important for them to be explicit so that we understand that it's not enough just to not do what is destructive, but we also need to be doing what is affirming. Both are practices. And so there's a direct understanding, and this is the first way to understand this precept, is to do just what it says. And the Buddha said it this way: abandon taking what is not given, abstain from taking what is not given. Take only what is given, accept only what is given, live not by stealth, but by means of a self that has become honest and clear. Very simple. Don't take or accept what has not been given. Abandon the taking of what is not given. Don't live by stealth, by deception, but rather live by honesty and clearness. Be clear. And so the first understanding is just that, that in every moment, at all times, in all situations, don't take what hasn't been given to us, to you or me. And in a sense, this recognizes that, of course, it directly deals with our greed, right? Which is one of the three poisons. And on the other side, it is cultivating generosity, which is one of the qualities of an awakened being, to be magnanimous and generous, to be giving. And so it's trying to soften that impulse or weaken, to sort of dry up that impulse to take, to want and grasp, and at the same time to be strengthening that basic way of being in the world, which is to be generous. And it's also, of course, related to attachment, because wanting to have, you know, that impulse is attachment itself, and then getting that thing, taking that thing which doesn't belong to us, is based in wanting to possess it, is attachment. And so, of course, all of this is working exactly against what we're trying to develop, which is a life based in non-attachment. So in that way, this precept is very simple and direct, and it's very, very deep and important because it's going right to the heart of that grasping mind. And also it recognizes that we're physical beings living in a physical world where we relate to things, all kinds of things, material things, non-material things, that those give us pleasure, right? Buddhism recognizes that, that when we find pleasure in things. And those are wants and needs, but they're also just desires, and that there are moments or passing experiences of pleasure in those things, which do bring pleasure into our lives. They pass, that pleasure passes. It's not a lasting kind of pleasure. It doesn't go that deep, but it does give us moments of pleasure and enrichment. The second way of understanding this precept, and this is moving more into the Mahayana tradition, is that if we just relate to that precept as it's stated, then it becomes a rule, a fixed rule. Sometimes to adhere to that rule might actually not be compassionate, right? Because now that sense of morality is being fixed, it's become rigid. And that's one of the cautions about the moral teachings, is don't become righteous in our morality. In other words, don't become attached to our morality. Practice it. Practice it in accord with our conditions, but don't attach to it, because then there are going to be moments where it's because we're attached to the rule, that rule of not stealing is no longer in accord with what's actually happening. And so sometimes we see that we're in a situation where it may be necessary to take something which doesn't belong to us out of compassion, and reverence for life. And that's the thing, right? That it's not self-serving, that it's for out of compassion for the situation, someone else, and so to take what has not been given to us actually upholds that precept, the spirit of that precept, which is compassion. And then the third precept is more unique to the Zen tradition. It's called the Bodhidharma One Mind precept. And this, teaching of this says that self-nature is inconceivably wondrous. And so this way of understanding the precept is based in a realization of our Buddha nature, our basic nature as being empty. It goes on to say, in the Dharma in which nothing can be obtained, in which there is no self and other, no this and that, in that self-nature, that realization, that state, not giving rise to a thought of obtaining is called the precept of refraining from stealing. And so from within that understanding, there is no self and other. There is, desire is empty. There's no self in the person. There's no self-own power in the desire itself. There's no lasting quality in the fulfillment of that desire. All of that is empty. And so to even give rise to the thought of taking goes against that basic understanding. Okay, so these are the three understandings that we work with in our lineage. One is just the direct understanding, don't take what hasn't been given, be giving. When necessary, out of compassion and reverence for life, take what has not been given. Be clear about that, though. And the third is based in the truth of our self-nature is empty, to even give rise to the thought of taking, of stealing, goes against that precept. Now, to make things a little bit more interesting, Yasutani Roshi said that we should also, when we're practicing this precept, all the precepts, we can look at it from various perspectives. The time in which this is taking place, and that might be this moment. It might be the time of day. It might be the time of month or year. It might be the time of history. Place, the place in which that action is occurring. What he's pointing to is that all of these things impact on the action. The action isn't taking place in a void. Right? It's taking place within a context. We, in the people, the actors in that moment, are being influenced by that context. They're acting within that context. We shouldn't ignore that. Because different times and different places change how that action will be understood, how it will be perceived, the karmic consequences of that action. Interesting. And so what all of that is pointing to is that no action has an absolute value. It's based in, because nothing is fixed, it's based in a whole intricate web of causation, of karma. But that doesn't mean that every action is just relative. It doesn't mean that if it's good for you, it's good for you, and if it's bad for me, it's bad for me. It doesn't mean that. So time and place, position, Yasutani Roshi said, what is your position to the situation, the person you're impacting, and degree? What degree of action is necessary? So in terms of not taking, or in terms of taking, if that would be the more compassionate action, what degree of action is necessary? We can also, now traditionally, of course, this precept was pointing to things, property, the stuff that we take, right? The things we steal. In a larger sense, we can also think of it in terms of non-material things, time, to take time that doesn't belong to us, to take away trust, to take sexuality that has not been given, to take another sense of personhood, some aspect of their personhood that has not been freely offered. You understand? So we can look at this in all kinds of ways because our mind can be of a taking nature, a stealing nature, a taking what has not been given nature that can land in all manner of ways. Okay, so those are various ways in which we study and practice these precepts. So when students are training in the precepts, or if you come to the retreats that I lead and some of the other teachers will be leading, this is what we talk about. And this, again, is to really help us appreciate that these precepts are very, very direct. Anybody can understand them at a basic level, but they also have a tremendous amount of depth. And for that reason, they really require, they need us to study them and to study them in life and over time so that we can really look at these from these different perspectives and manifest them. Then the other side is to be giving, right? Which is really just that, to live in non-attachment, to be generous, to be unfettered. Remember the first paramita is dana paramita, to give freely. And there are many practices. In fact, so much of training is all of these various moments and gestures. It's in the various forms that we engage in that are moments of giving. Moments of giving. A bow. Right? Caretaking is an expression of giving. Zazen should really be an expression of our giving. Living our lives should really be an expression of being of a giving nature rather than a taking nature. Okay? Because when we are giving, when that's our basic way, everything opens up. Right? So if you think of the nature of taking, you know, which is to pull in, or the nature of stinginess, which is another precept, to not be withholding, which is to hold in, right, and try and preserve, right, that we can't contain that. So that when that is our impulse, that our whole being takes on that posture, if you will. Whereas when we release that, when we practice non-attachment, when we practice letting go, our whole being begins to manifest that. And everything internally begins to manifest that. So let me stop there. And I think I've said enough to start. Hope I haven't said too much. And so then let's just explore this. Questions about anything that I brought up, or just questions about this precept itself? Either side. To not take what has not been given, to be giving, in terms of how you are exploring that or how you're experiencing that or challenges you have with that.
I think this has been asked before, but especially now I'm riding the subway every day and there's always somebody asking for something and I never know whether to give or not. And I feel stingy, and especially late at night, it's usually someone you know is homeless, and I don't want to whip my wallet out on the subway at 2 o'clock in the morning, or what. I always have these reasons, you know, so I feel stingy, but like I tip generously and I give where I feel like I can. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to work that.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the important functionings of the precepts is that they're part of what we've inherited, right? So they're part of our legacy. They're part of the gift that we've received from the teachers of the past, from the Buddha. And they're given to us as guides. So these precepts are training precepts, right? They're not absolutes. They're not, you know, measures of perfection. They're how to train. How do we train ourselves? What are the things we need to really pay attention to that human beings universally do that creates the most binding karma? And because of that, when we begin to transform those, they become gates to liberation. And so they have the power to be the most binding, but also have to give us the greatest release. And so when we study the precepts and we take them on, take them in, when we take them formally as vows, they, in a sense, belong to us. They belong to you. And so each of, which means each of us is challenged in those moments to examine that precept within ourselves. How do I live my, how do I want to live my life? How do I live it in this very real situation, right? That in the city occurs over and over again. And there can be all kinds of, you know, ways of looking at that rationally and, you know, statistically or, you know, socioeconomically or from the point of view of, you know, class. I mean, there are all ways of looking at it. But at that moment, there's just this person in you, right? On a subway platform late at night. And so, and I think that's really important, is that we allow ourselves to question, to examine. And so one thing this precept is saying is that we can always be giving, because that's our nature. How we give, what we give, is open, right? And so we when somebody asks for something specific, we think that that is the only, may think that's the only conduit for giving that exists, right? I remember years ago I was driving down the highway. Jimon was in the car, and we passed somebody who was broken down. Broken down, I don't remember, but there was somebody on the side of the road. And I started to pull over. I was going to pull over, and Jimon said, "I don't feel comfortable." She it was a guy, and she just said, "I just have a bad feeling." She said, "I don't feel safe." And I said, "Okay." So I kept driving. And I felt conflicted inside because I wanted her to feel safe, and I didn't know, you know, maybe she was picking on up on something that I wasn't. But I also felt like I wanted to see if I could do something, and I thought, well, that opportunity's over, it's gone. And then we came up to a toll booth, and I thought, oh. And so I told the person in the toll booth, you know, there's somebody that I think needs some help back there, maybe you could call a trooper. And so for me, that was a very simple, unexpected moment where I thought, you know, I had sort of closed the door, that opportunity was over, but then something presented itself. And so with giving, you know, if we understand there are different ways of giving, and that then that opens the door, you know, to greater consideration. And so, you know, when I'm in the city, oftentimes what I'll do, because I don't, you know, necessarily want to take out my wallet, you know, anywhere, but I might just take a few bucks and stick it in my pocket, so that as I pass people who I want to offer something, I can very easily just do that. I mean, there are a lot of ways that people respond. I've had lots of conversations with students over the years about that, because it's such a frequent experience that we have here, you know, and an important one, really, because there are people who are in all different kinds of situations, and the fact that they're asking us means we are in a different position, at least on that level, to some degree. And so there is the opportunity to give, and we may or may not want to give money, but is there something else, whether it be a gesture or a smile or a wish of well-being, explicitly or inwardly? You know, I mean, when we understand, you know, that was part of the Buddha's revolution about understanding the power of intention. And it thought, that thought creates karma. And so obviously, if I give someone, you know, some money, that has a different impact and a more tangible impact than if I wish them well-being in my mind. Who does that help? Well, it helps me, for sure. So when I express a genuine concern for somebody else, and I notice them, I take the time to do that, I care enough to do that, that helps me. I know that. And the power of mind is such that I have faith. I see the ways in which mind has impact all the time. It's not measurable. And so based in faith, that faith, then I feel trusting and offering that. I wouldn't try and measure it, but it is something, right? And so just to keep that door open. Anybody else?
So one of the things you mentioned earlier was about how our zazen should be an expression of giving. And you know, a lot of the times when I am sitting, I do feel it tends to be very, you know, that kind of not giving. How can we really, you know, express the giving in something like Zazen, which for me, and I assume for other people, kind of feels very self-centered a lot of the time.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to try and make that larger and more inclusive of others. And so, because in our Zazen, certainly in the beginning and for some time, you know, we're very focused on this mind, this body, these thoughts, these emotions, these memories, and it seems very much about ourselves, and in a certain way it is. At the same time, we are studying the nature of mind, which is universal. We're also studying humanity in this particular expression, but humanity is also universal. And so when you examine your anger or your sadness, your attachments, those are universal experiences that every person has, right? You're just experiencing them in your own particular, you know, storyline. And so in that way, it is much larger. And that's giving you understanding and insight and eventually brings forth compassion for others, because as you understand all of those things within yourself, then it's easier to understand them in others. And so that in itself is a kind of giving. When you practice not judging, you know, not being self-critical, basically being kind to yourself, then that is a very direct expression of compassion and giving. And just practicing letting go of attachments is a form of giving. You know, so if you think of our attachments as not necessarily taking, well, in a sense, you could say it's taking things that don't belong to us. Our thoughts, our memories, our emotions, our physical sensations do not belong to us. The Buddha said that, right? We experience them, but we cannot possess them. Attachments are trying to possess something, right? So when we attach to any of those internal experiences, in a sense, we could look at it from the point, I've never really thought about it that way, but we could look at it from the point of view of, you know, we're trying to steal something that doesn't actually belong to us, as opposed to just acknowledging it, right, and letting it pass, which is really allowing it to be in its basic state. So that's a form of giving. And then to really more directly make it larger, you know, to in your mind, at the beginning of your day, if you have an altar and you're lighting a stick of incense, or you're just beginning your Zazen, and just to hold in your mind the thought of someone or some group or all sentient beings, and to, in your mind, articulate, express the desire for their well-being, for their happiness, for their lack of suffering. I mean, this is what the teaching of the Four Immeasurables, or the Divine Abidings, is. It's just expressing that loving kindness, that compassion, that gladness, and that equanimity. And so in that way, you're cultivating, because in order to do that, you have to be thinking about somebody other than yourself, right? So that automatically and necessarily makes your mind larger and more inclusive. And in the same way, it opens your heart, right? Because you're sort of bringing forth a feeling of love or compassion, and so it's engendering empathy. And when we do that over and over and over again, make that a daily part of our practice, that has a very powerful effect. Okay, and it will help to actually make our Zazen, and help us to understand it is, but actually make it larger, and not just for ourselves.
Thank you.
A while back, I read a book there was talked about metta, and this woman suggested that you, when you're going out and you're walking down the street, you should say in your mind, you may your life go well. She had a whole little prayer that which I forgot, but I did that for a while, and then I started saying, thinking that it was a selfish thing, because I was looking for good to come to me through what I was doing, and my Christian background tells me that anytime you the only good deed is one that nobody knows about and you don't get anything from. And I don't know how to explain right or wrong.
Yeah, I would disagree with that, because you know, there is no absolute. And so this is something that a lot of times students get a little tangled up in, because there's this teaching or an emphasis in the precepts that it's selfless, you know, so to give, you know, to really give selflessly. And so sometimes then it becomes very complicated. It's like, well, I'm not really sure if it's entirely selfless. Like, maybe I have some ulterior motives. I think I'm wanting to help, but I'm not sure. And it gets very complicated. And then the moment's gone, right? And so, you know, so rather than striving for perfection, trust in oneself, and that you know, whatever degree of generosity is in that action, that's real. And the more you do that, the stronger that will get. And if there is selfishness or, you know, wanting some reward riding along with it, if we're sincere in our practice, we will recognize that. If not now, over time, we'll begin to see those traces, you know, of self-clinging. And we'll be able to let those go and let that giving be more complete. And so, because otherwise, we never get off the couch. You know, because we're looking for some sort of, I'll start when I'm absolutely selfless. And that's just not the way, that's not real. And so, you know, in a way you could say that the karma of an action, when it's based in a clear intention for other, then the power of that is very strong. When when there's selfishness along with it, then in a way you could say it dampens it or holds it back a bit, you know, but none of this is measurable. It may be discernible, it may be felt or experienced. But again, I think along the path of practice, we have to work in that realm where we're moving forward and we're still carrying our karma with us, you know? And so we're practicing letting go more, being more generous, being more genuinely concerned for others, but we're still carrying, you know, aspects of our selfishness or our fear or our insecurity with us. And that's okay. I mean, that's true for everybody. And so I think we just keep really giving ourselves and sort of strengthening, you know, the non-grasping aspect of that. And that along the way, then we'll be practicing that otherwise. I think that's really, you know, when I say don't strive for perfection, that's really what I mean. Because that's just, it's chaotic. And it also creates an unreal, and I really mean unreal, story in our mind of what practice is supposed to be. And it's never presented that way. I mean, it's never been put that way. The teachings if you're anything, understand that
my husband, he can be very giving, but in kind of a different way. I recognize he can be very giving sometimes, especially when it doesn't work money.
Okay.
But there's times when we kind of butt heads against this.
Because, like, Dana Paramita, I have always loved this precept. I think it's so important. And he kind of sees me as being irresponsible mm-hmm. in that, you know. Like a very, very simple example is like, why wouldn't I tip 20%? Like the difference between 15 and 20% is usually a dollar. Mm-hmm. And he sees that as being foolish. Like, why aren't you being careful with your money? Why do you just want to give away? Yeah. And then I kind of get upset with him because I'm like, why are you so selfish? Mm-hmm. Why are you so greedy? You mm-hmm. have the money. Mm-hmm. And then I'm angry at him for not being generous. And I kind of are like, you know, you really need to go to the temple and you need to be more generous. And then I become completely ungenerous, ironically, because he's not being generous. And yeah. sometimes it's not about tipping. Sometimes he's doesn't want to share his money with me, which makes me even more. Yeah. So how do I help him to open up to be more generous without becoming ungenerous myself in this process?
Yeah, it's a great question. You remember when we were meeting before the wedding and we talked about various things that, you know, couples often tangle over, and I said, let's talk about money.
Yes.
Right? And the thing we talked about was, and that I usually talk about with a couple is, you know, I ask, what are your respective relationships with money? You know, do you worry about money? Do you feel very comfortable with money? Do you want to have a lot of money? Is it not that important to you? Not because I have any particular agenda, but really to see, is there a kind of, you know, a sort of a same, on the same page-ness here, or are there kind of different attitudes? Because that's going to have to get worked out, right? And so, but I think you're recognizing, you know, that you're trying to be generous here, but then it turns out being, you know, what might be perceived as not being so generous here. And so, again, not striving for perfection and how to, you know, cultivate being generous. I mean, one of the best teaching tools we have as human beings is our own example. It's just to be that thing. And so in that moment, money may be a very difficult medium for him, or a more difficult medium for him in which to be generous. And that may, you know, there may be valid reasons for that, certainly from his perspective. And so there may be other ways of demonstrating generosity or trying to cultivate generosity. But sometimes, you know, we can't force people. And so just to be an example or to be generous in our own lives, and then to, I mean, I remember talking about restaurants. I remember being in a restaurant one time, and I was a waiter for forever. I thought I would probably be in restaurants the rest of my life. I spent so many years in restaurant work. And so I knew what it was like to, you know, to be, you know, on the wait staff. And I was out to dinner with my father one time, and restaurants for some reason did not bring out the best in him. And I'll just leave it at that. And he was not being at his best on this particular night, and I was like dying, you know, and trying to like mitigate and, you know, and intercede and so on. And when we were leaving, I went and found the wait person, and I said, look, I'm so sorry. He's just being an asshole tonight. You were great. And I, you know, offered something. So that's, I'm not recommending that as a strategy. But again, it's just like, you know, how do we live? You know, these are in a way very simple and ordinary situations, but they come up a lot, you know, particularly in our relationships with people that are in our lives. And, you know, I think of the precepts, they're like living practices. And so many of these situations do occur over and over and over, which means there's karma that is accumulating. And so even though they may seem small, they're important. And the inner conflict or the inner, you know, particularly in a relationship, the inner resentment or unhappiness can also accumulate. So we need to be careful about that. But they also give us lots of opportunities to keep exploring, you know, by ourselves or with, you know, somebody else. How, you know, is there, can we make this larger?
Thank you so much for your talk. This is very inspiring. I was thinking about the situation where taking something can be acceptable or can lead to good karma. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking of my own work, which is about looking at different humanitarian situations. I work for an international organization, and you become a bit extractive in the way you gather information about what's happening in those camps, refugee camps. And sometimes you travel there and you just stay 3 days and you were there like a tourist, but you're actually taking from them something for to give them back, or at least I think that's what I'm going to do. But I think that happens a lot in our society of consumption and capitalism. Yeah. Just looking at a picture of a natural disaster or elsewhere is an unearned advantage that we as a society are using, but hopefully to trigger good karma or the act of giving.
Yeah, it's an interesting example of how, you know, we can come into contact with different people's lives and see it. You know, you said as a kind of tourist, we're just passing through. We're not that person or those people. We're not living that life, and that in a way we can take something, you know, that isn't really being freely given. And so what, you know, to use that, you know, for a beneficial purpose, then is sort of the imperative, becomes the imperative. My mom just passed away in early January, and I was with her for the last week leading up to her death, and she was progressing towards death very, very quickly. And so I had the opportunity to really be close with her and be, you know, alongside her every day. And I really wanted to photograph her because she's my mother, and I wanted to remember this because it was such a powerful experience. And also because she was transforming before my eyes in a way that was very stark, and also there was something very beautiful about it. And I wanted to, you know, I knew I would have a memory, but I wanted to have something more, but I didn't. Because I didn't want to ask her, and I didn't want to do that without asking her. And so I just let that go. Because it felt like it would be taking something that I wasn't sure was mine to have. And so to me, these are just examples of how these precepts, you know, when we study them and we really reflect on them, they become much larger. We find them appearing in all of these different moments that we wouldn't have thought of that way before. And in that way, they bring our attention and can help us just examine and sort of bring our own sense of I am in this moment, I am having some kind of impact. What is that? And try and just be conscious about that. And sometimes we don't know. You know, we don't know what that impact might be. And so the precept is really to, you know, just is based in the pure precepts, which is try and create the least amount of harm possible and do as much good as we can with whatever that situation is. And so if we are impacting in some way that might have some negative aspect, to try and, in a sense, offset that or turn that into something positive. Yeah. Well, I think that's where intention alone, as important as it is, that's why Yasutani Roshi's time, place, position, degree is important. Because, you know, it's not that if as long as I have a good intention, then I'm off the hook, right? That whatever the consequences don't matter because I had a good intention. It's sort of like in oppression work, you know, that if I say something that is offensive to someone, to a person of color, to a woman, that and it hurts them, and I say, well, that's not what I meant. I didn't mean that. What I'm really saying is, therefore, I'm sort of disregarding your hurt because I didn't mean it. And that's not, and so that emphasis on impact is more important than intention. You know, from a Buddhist perspective, they're both important. But my intention not to hurt you may have been based in my ignorance, that I'm not aware of what I'm saying because I haven't really studied you or oppression or me, for that matter. I haven't studied me. You know, I haven't studied what it means to be male, what it means to be white. And so I'm unwittingly, right, saying things that are hurtful to other people. Because, and even though my intention may be not, my intention is sort of shrouded in a kind of ignorance. And so as bodhisattvas, you know, the 100 hands and arms of Avalokiteshvara, you know, all of those implements with which to manifest compassion, you know, part of that is educating ourselves, being informed as much as possible about the world we're living in, the people we're relating to, the cultures that we move in and out of, you know, the world that we've grown up in, and that's a different world than the world many other people that we live around and with have grown up in, you know, just basic, like, good human training. And so that we can be more aware, right? I mean, to me, being awake really means being awake in every way possible. So it means spiritually, in the deepest level, it means socially, it means in terms of time and place. It means as much as I can to the people that I am with, you know, awake to the consequences of my actions, just awake. I think what we begin to see, you know, I was remembering, because I was talking to somebody recently about the precepts, and we just did a precept retreat at the monastery, and when I first started training, we didn't have those preparatory retreats, and so, you know, at a certain point in time, I'd become a student, I went to my teacher, and I said, I'd like to do the precepts. He said, why? I don't remember what I said, but he said, okay. And it was fairly straightforward. It was between me and him. And then I did the precepts. And during that week, you know, he hadn't written The Heart of Being yet. So there was no book. I don't know if The Mind of Clover had been written yet by Aiken. So there was very little material on the precepts. But I read them. I saw them. I thought, okay, you know, I got that. And then during the week of training, each day, he met with us, me and the group I was in, and he was teaching about the precepts. And as the week was going on, I was like, oh. It's like, I really don't get this. Like, there's a lot. And I remember that on that Sunday, after I had done the ceremony, received the vows formally, I was walking outside, and I remember thinking, what just happened? You know, I had the sense that something really significant had happened, and I had a little bit of an idea about it. You know, in others, I realize I just stepped into something that's much larger than I know. In a sense, that's always true when we take a vow, right? You got to leap. But I realized I sort of felt the inadequacy of my understanding, you know, and I realized I have work to do to really understand what just happened. And so that's why I feel good and strongly about the retreats we do, because I think they really, I hope they do, and I think they really do help to help us to understand these teachings so that we're not just seeing them, you know, at face value, superficially. Because then they come alive.
The big sticking point I find for me in a lot of in giving and in some other precepts has to do with feeling I need to protect myself, you know? And I was, when Mary was talking about in her marriage, I find in my marriage is like the stickiest, most challenging place, you know, because my wife is the closest person to me. It becomes so real. It's so intimate. My daughter's another story because she's a child, right? But I have had these times where it's like, oh, well, there's a situation where I could be generous, but then I'm like, oh, there's sometimes my wife's, we're both a little crazy, because that's how we are as people. So sometimes I'm like, oh, she's being fucked up. So actually, I have to protect myself in this case. Now, sometimes I'm being fucked up. So it's not like one or the other. But there's a moment of sometimes like realize self and other as one. And I've had this experience where I'm just like, oh, we're separate and we're against each other. And then I'm like, oh, we have to step inside this together. Yeah. And it makes a huge difference. I mean, it's really striking, just that shift. But it's not always easy to do. And I just want to express that, you know, that to me, in terms of giving it, a lot of it just has to do with fear. Mm. And like, how much money can I give away? And luckily, we're kind of on the same page with that. But I give a certain amount of money away every month to because of all the crazy things that are happening. Mm. And you know, I don't know what's the right amount. Like, what's going to happen now? Not to get too obtuse, but our Congress passed a law that's creating an enormous national debt, which means that when I retire, I'm not going to get the Social Security that I would have gotten otherwise. So all these factors come in, and it makes it quite difficult. And there's a moment of wanting to give. And there's also within that, like just a sense of, you know, can I do that? Or if I'm giving now, am I going to be hurt? And my responsibility for my own self in the relative sense, like I have to also take care of myself. At a certain point, sometimes I have to be, you know, not giving, perhaps is the word, or something, in order to actually just be maintaining the integrity of myself. Or the, you know, like I would protect another person, you know?
Yeah, well, so, you know, to really make a study on every level of non-duality, so the duality between giving and taking, between self and other, you know, so the Bodhisattva vow to alleviate the suffering of all beings means that, right? Every being, you and every other. And so, you know, the Buddha acknowledged that we naturally have self-interest. You know, we feel our own body, we feel our aches and pains, we feel our own sickness, we feel our emotions rising and falling directly. We have empathy for other people. We don't feel their aches and pains. We don't feel their emotions rising and falling. And so, that's biological, and it's as it must be. And so, in a sense, we have the deepest vested interest in our own well-being, right? Which works out because only you can practice your mind. And you have the deepest vested interest in your mind, right? And I have the same in mind. And so that's sort of understood. And then the Bodhisattva vow is, okay, as you are liberating yourself at every step, realize that before we even understand it and before we realize it, that your nature and the nature of others is one nature. That your well-being and the well-being of others is united. Just as you spoke about in your, I mean, that's what we see in our relationships, you know? And so to just work within that and work towards that, there is a groundedness in it. And so the Buddha in a number of different sutras is teaching lay students, and he lays out, I mean, he's a homeless monk, for goodness sake, but he's laying out the economy of a householder. You know, this is how much you should save, this is how much you should spend, this is how much you should give away. And he recognizes that you need to keep a certain amount for the future. You need to spend a certain amount for today. It's good to give away a certain amount. You know, and so how each of us does that, you know, is based on our own economies. But there is a recognition of that. And I think that's just part of that living aspect about, you know, being in the world, and a fluctuating world, an impermanent world, a uncertain world. And so, and you have a responsibility towards your family, and that's real. And so, you know, all of those things have to be part of that consideration. But I think when we in our minds set them up as being opposed to each other, then there will be problems. And at the same time, it's not always clear as we try and let go of those boundaries what that resolution is, or what that, you know, because that, it's like I say, the Dharma doesn't tell us what to do. You know, it doesn't answer our questions, but it keeps directing us, you know, to how to bring forth our own natural state of mind so that we can see things as clearly as possible, and then look even more deeply to see the underlying basis of things so that we can bring that into our relationships. You know, your story reminded me of years ago, we had a student who was, he was trying to think of how to describe him. He was, this isn't quite fair, but it helps to say, let's say he was sloppy, okay? And he got married, and his wife was very, you know, like things to be in order. And so he was complaining to me once that they take turns cooking and doing the dishes. Whoever cooks, the other person does the dishes. And so he said, when I cook and she does the dishes, it's fine because she does them right away. When she cooks and I do the dishes, I don't do them right away because I don't like to. You know, I don't want to clean the dish right up. So and she gets upset because she's like, when are you going to do the dishes? And so they have this thing. And I said, why don't you just give her that? Right? You see that it causes her pain. Is it really that important to you? Why don't you just give her that? Right? Just do the dishes. And it's done. And he started to say, but if I do that, you know, it'll never end, you know? It's like, and it's this whole, you know, it's like this bargaining sort of mentality. And I said, you don't know that. I said, another way of looking at that is that when you give that, you're embodying generosity, right? You're being generous, not a sucker, you know? So I don't know how that all went down. Okay, maybe one more.
You mentioned that when you received the precepts, that afterward you weren't sure what had just happened. I guess I'm curious, what is it to formally receive vows that you've sort of already been vowing to do? I mean, you know, the precepts on their surface anyway are things that I think we all try to do in our daily lives. Maybe this is a very individual question for each person who takes Jukai, but I've been thinking about that. Like, what is that to formally take vows that...
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, you know, because we chant the four vows frequently and, you know, that everybody who practices here chants the four vows. But that's not the same as taking the four vows. And so, we're getting acquainted with them. We're being exposed to those teachings. We're sort of taking them in, maybe, you know, engaging them, reflecting on them, and so on. And we may, I mean, a person may personally feel committed to those vows and, in a sense, personally take them, you know, as in their, within themselves. There is something that happens when we do that publicly within the community in which those vows exist that I think is part of just our human nature. It's part of our nature as being communal beings. It also is part of the functioning of a sangha, is that we, you know, we sort of are born together, we grow up together, we hold each other together, and part of that is we hold each other in those vows. And, you know, Dogen spoke of an inner conversion. He was speaking of it in terms of bodhicitta, but I think with vows there is an internal shift that takes place because, remember, it happens over time. A person enters into training and they're chanting the four vows and they might start thinking about it. They see other people who have done Jukai. What's that about? You know, they may be interested, they may not. It's like, I don't want to do that. But it's a presence in their consciousness. And that over time, if they choose, if they want to move in that direction, then they're going to be engaging that more actively, right? They're going to be studying them because I'm going to ask them to, and but I mean, they're doing it because they want to, not just because I'm asking them to. And so it's much more active. They're bringing questions into Doksan about the precepts and doing these retreats. So there's a whole sort of, you know, bubbling, you know, pot of consciousness that's in which those precepts have been dropped. And so when they, and then they spend that week sewing their raksu, and we spend time together, and, you know, it's pretty powerful. And so in that ceremony, and you'd have to ask each person what it was for them, but the intention is that there'd be a real sense that they have taken those vows, received them, and that they themselves have done that. You know, it hasn't happened to them. And that inner shift is that, yes, this makes sense to me. This is an expression of how I want to be in the world. I don't fully understand them. I sure as hell am not living them completely, but that's my vow. That's why I'm taking these vows, because that's what I want to do. Okay, hi. Maybe one more, Christine.
This question may be more about grasping than taking what is not being given, so I don't quite know how it falls into. It has to do with ambition, professional ambition. You know, this is a hard city, and we, many of us, lead complicated lives, mm-hmm. and the economics are complicated, and there's this constant pressure to see something and put yourself there so you can take it. And I don't mean take it from somebody else. Mm-hmm. And you have to make opportunities for yourself. You have to do a lot of different things. And so it gets wearing. So the constant feeling, oh, I have to do this, or I have to get this, and then this will happen, and I have to get this, and I have to line this and this and this up. And that's wearing. And so what I tell myself is that, well, do it so it's not grasping. Do it so you make an opening, you know, that so you make an opportunity, and it opens things instead of feeling like this, you know, greed.
Yeah.
But it's hard.
I agree. But I think it's really important, because that part of us which sees something that we want to move towards, you know, aspiration, is essential. It's essential. I mean, it's essential to life. It's essential to our development as just a person. I mean, if I think back about, you know, from, you know, being a child, and having ambition or having aspiration towards something, you know, whether it was I wanted to buy a go-kart, right? And so I had to get a job to earn the money to do that. So the goal of being able to buy this thing, this was the process of that taught me a whole heap of stuff, right? It was this very rich experience. And I can think of all of, you know, so many of the things that I aspired to and had ambition for. And in a sense, you know, we have to have ambition or aspiration in the Dharma, right? This doesn't just happen. And so, but the key is just what you said. You know, we have such an acquisitional mentality. I mean, think of our country. Think about taking what was not given. From the very beginning, we took what was not given, right? And we didn't just take, but we destroyed lives and communities and cultures. And I mean, that's in our origins. That's like in our placenta, you know. That's a very, very deep karmic truth. And then it just went on, right? Taking people, right? That didn't belong to us. That belong to themselves, you know. So this legacy that is our nation, you know, is inconceivable in its magnitude. And so that, and I'm, it's not that I'm drawing a direct causal relationship, but I believe there is a direct causal relationship to our mentality today, which is, you know, I was just talking to somebody recently who is a person who lives in a very in very wealthy circles, and we were talking about service and giving, and I said, have you observed, you know, amongst people in your sphere, do you see, do you experience, you know, a sort of a general inclination to be care about other people and people who don't have wealth and so on and so forth? And she said, no. She said, not like I used to. She said, more and more, it's very, very self-directed. It's very much self-promotional. It's very much me. And I don't think I'm saying anything that we don't know. But so I think that's, we're in a culture. You know, it's not just you. It's, we're in a culture that worships at the altar of that acquisition, of taking, right? And so to be a practitioner, you know, means to really do what is not going to be easy to do. Not just because it in and of itself is difficult, because we're working within extremely powerful forces and we have been conditioned since the beginning, right? And so to go another way, to sort of be in the same stream that everybody else is moving in around you, but to really in your mind, to be trying to really see this and be going in a different way requires a great degree of, you know, of sort of keeping your eye on the ball and finding your own way, because that way hasn't been laid out for you, right? The way of taking, that's been laid out, right? Just follow the examples. But this is something new. It means we're going to have to explore how do we do that. You know, I think of this when I was a musician and was, you know, performing and competing, you know, for, you know, awards and, you know, opportunities and so on. And, you know, and how easy it was to fall into a competition against all of these guys, as opposed to, what if I just play the very best I can because I love music? In other words, I try and excel. I have the ambition to excel here, right? Not here against there. But I had to keep bringing that back, had to keep reminding myself, you know, of how to sort of orient myself. So.
For taking it to the societal level, because I've been, oh no, is it on? Yeah. I wanted to say thank you for taking it to the societal level, because I've had a comment that I've just been like holding in because I didn't want to be a bummer. But I moved here from a country where I was the minority and there was institutionalized discrimination, to a country where as a woman I face a lot of barriers, but I'm also benefiting from a lot of privilege. Yeah. And I work in public health and racial inequities, and so I'm part of many groups in a race to justice, and that's so salient to me every day. And I feel like, as we're talking, I just feel like I'm violating this precept every day. Mm-hmm. Like I'm benefiting from this every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So?
It's incredibly painful. And how do you work with that pain?
Okay. But it, how, other than, in addition to just practicing the pain, what can you do to about that reality?
Well, I think I'm trying to address it in my work. I mean, I'm trying to be giving, yeah, in my work.
And turn things, change things, change systems. Yeah. Yeah. That's why it's, you know, it's so important to not get hung up on perfection. I mean, we're all enlightened beings and we're all deluded. I think all of us are trying to live in our lives in a way that are giving and are generous and are actually beneficial. And we're all, in some ways, causing suffering. Right? And you know, I talked about this recently, that, you know, whenever we're working in the realm where anything matters, we're in a realm of risk, right? Because it matters means we're dealing with people, we're getting somehow impacting their lives, being impacted by them, which means we can impact them negatively, right? For various reasons. But otherwise, we never get close enough to help or be helped. And so risk comes with it, right? That's why the Buddha said we have to have courage, right? And we have to be willing to be imperfect beings, striving, aspiring to be awake in our imperfection. And as the faith mind says, then we can let go of our anxiety about imperfection. All right. Okay, maybe one more. Gloria, did you have your...
Yeah. I, on a related note, I was just going to say that I feel guilty a lot of the time because I'm, you know, financially comfortable, I guess. I wouldn't say I'm like the richest person in the city because that's ridiculous, or among the top tier, but I'm definitely not struggling really. And, you know, but I also have worked really hard to get to where I am. And I sometimes feel guilty that I'm not doing more. Like, I should be doing way more than what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I give money to homeless people sometimes on the subway. Sometimes I tip well, just randomly. You know, I do these kind of like small acts of kindness, I guess. And, you know, I know every little bit helps, but I'm, you know, I go to work every day and have a nice salary. And, you know, I really could just, I should be doing more. Like, I should, you know, I want to sometimes. I don't need all the things that I have. Like, I don't, you know, I don't think we live too extravagant, but I mean, I definitely don't need all the things that I have. And so I feel guilty that I'm not doing more. Like, I should, you know, life's too short and I have my health, and like, why am I not, you know, quitting my job and working for a nonprofit or something? Like, why am I working for a giant corporation? And I don't know, this is something I struggle with a lot, actually. So,
well, I would just encourage you to work with the guilt, because guilt is not a healthy or a helpful emotion to stay in. You know, it can bring our attention to something like this inner conflict, but that we really need to turn that into more constructive energy, because it can actually be paralyzing and can actually serve to sort of stop us from doing what we might actually do to move forward or to resolve that inner conflict. And so, I mean, in a certain sense, I never am doing enough, ever. Right? I mean, I feel that keenly. In any direction I look in, any direction, this way, you know, I mean, in the sense that could I be doing more? Yeah. You know, but so that's just kind of a tension that I live with, I hold. And part of that is I want to do more, right? I want to do more, right? But I also have to take care of what I have, stay healthy, and take care of the responsibilities I have. And so it's that tension, you know, between holding and, you know, sort of holding this and expanding. And so I just think, but to let it be a living thing, and for me it is. It's not something to me these are not questions that get answered and then you put them on the shelf. They're constantly changing. And so it may be that, you know, to really examine that and to look at, you know, what kind of life do you want to be living? Or what, within the life that you have, what kind of opportunities do you already have to try and affect some good? You know, and then to go beyond that, you know, what can we do in our own realms, or to go into other realms to affect good that work within the life that you have. Some people just change their whole lives around, right? in order to satisfy that yearning. But most of us, I think, try and find ways within the life that we have to meet all of those various needs. And because we are limited, you know, we have to make limited decisions, right? And find our and find our peace without becoming complacent. Find our peace within those limitations and just realize that's just the nature of being in a physical world, right? And it's also, I think, the burden of living in our particular time where we have so much delivered to our doorstep, right? I mean, you know, the world used to be, you know, what we could see, you know, up to the, you know, to the horizon. And so now we have this sense, and I don't know, you know, biologically, if we were wired to hold that much magnitude, you know, so not taking could be understood as, you know, that I am taking from people that haven't even been born yet. You know, by the way I consume, by the way the culture I live in consumes. You know, so these precepts, from that perspective, have a whole life to them that's, you know, going far into the future. And so we can get overwhelmed with that and become paralyzed, which isn't helping anybody. And so I think better just take that energy and turn it into, you know, just start anywhere. Start simple, start small. But also don't limit ourselves. You know, recognize we live within limitations, but at the same time, you know, don't rush towards those limitations, you know, and kind of find them as, find our safety in them. Which means we're going to be uncomfortable. You know, we're going to be uncomfortable acknowledging the suffering that is in the world that we can't fix. And that's at the heart of compassion. In order to manifest compassion, we have to be willing to hold that suffering and know that we can't fix it, but we can do something. And to do our work there.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.